This is Off Planet Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to Off Planet Radio. I'm Randy Moggins, and we welcome you to another session. We're going to have some real interesting stuff coming up tonight, this morning, this afternoon, whenever, wherever, and however.
It doesn't exist, Randy.
That's right. It doesn't. That's Evelyn. Hey, Em.
Hi. How's everybody doing? Just glad to be back. And before we get into the show, I was mentioning to our guest and to Randy before that I went to the Depeche Mode concert last night, and it was really good. But man, also, like, it was, and I don't find these things to be bad things anymore, but man, it was really triggering in some ways. Their music, that was some of the, like, I loved that when I was like in seventh and eighth and ninth grade. That was first music t-shirt I ever had was a Depeche Mode t-shirt. And it was so interesting. Like, in the days kind of leading up to it, I was thinking about that music a lot and sort of remembering those times. And it was very interesting how what the music meant to me then and what it meant to me now. And how, like, the same lyrics, like, in hindsight, like, I just, the way it sort of, music over time intertwines with your life and what it means sort of when you first hear it. And then in hindsight, especially with all the other things we know about how this stuff is, you know, how this stuff is used to program us, but, you know, how this music is also just really amazing. Their music is amazing, and it was a great show. If anybody out there, they're still haven't played in your city, I highly recommend it.
It's the best music the Tavistock Institute had to offer.
Yes. No, I mean, it's one of those things that it's like, you know, I can't explain it, but, like, there's some music you're like, ah, this is just good music, or this is just crap music. But
and in all fairness, this Depeche Mode has maintained a real high level over the years. Their music really cuts into the core of a lot of things. What's going on in the background is a little bit more complex than just the synth pop that you think you're hearing with them.
Yeah, it was very, like, you know, there's some of this music you hear, some of it's good, some of it's crap, you know, whatever. There's a few select, or there's sort of like a thread of artists or like a certain group of artists that their music has, it's something else, man. It means something else. It has all of this sort of kaleidoscopic array of stuff intertwined with it. And Depeche Mode is definitely that. And let me just tell you, Dave Gahan was phenomenal. Like, I used to listen to them, but I never really watched them before. He's a fantastic performer. And I didn't realize he was so flamboyant. Like, he was very flamboyant and very charismatic. And they all still sound great. Like, sometimes you go see some of these older bands and they've lost a little bit, but it's still fun to hear their music. These guys haven't lost it. And they actually really seem to be enjoying themselves, like, certainly much more than they were 10 or 15 years back when they were having some issues with drugs and whatever.
Yeah, a lot less coke now.
Well, I think Dave Gahan was into heroin. And he seemed so happy and just so in his element last night. And it was really good. And the sound was unreal. Like, their music sounds amazing live. Some of it almost actually sounded kind of different than it does when you hear it on the radio. But different, better. It was really good. I had a really good time. So everybody go check out Depeche Mode.
Cool. Well, we have a guest, yeah, as you know, but I don't. So let's bring our guest on. We know him. You know him as Medicine Bear White Bow. And he is survivor of mind control programs going back to childhood, specifically MK Delta. He is also a practitioner of Native American lore, medicine, healing, the use of drum circles, the use of the pipe. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that, but we want to welcome Medicine Bear back to Off Planet TV, Off Planet Radio.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you back on, brother. anybody that's seen the previous show that we did with you in Storm, which was a little over, I guess, about a year ago, we'll know some of the backdrop to this and some of the things that we're going to talk about, Bear. I thought maybe leading off for this talk, you're actually right now moving into a very big Gear Up program with the lodge that you had and some of those things that you've envisioned for a long time in terms of being able to put together a lodge, do drum circles, and to bring people into a place of using the Native American lore for healing. Tell us a little bit about that as well as a little bit about yourself, brother.
Well, as far as Rainbow People's Medicine Lodge goes, it's been a very fluid, flowing, changing river of sorts. And sometimes the stream gets a little stopped up and as things slow down and then next thing you know, the dam breaks and it's a gusher. And the last 9 months I have had an overabundance of email, snail mail, telephone calls. When are we're coming to Las Vegas. We're trying to find a sweat lodge. I had some TV producers that contacted me. They're getting ready to shoot. I'm not sure what the movie is going to be or who's in it or anything like that. But his talent scout had contacted me, and I'm not even sure which producer it is, but coming out in January, and they want to have a place to come and take all their people and put them through a sweat lodge. And that kind of got the juices flowing a few months ago. And what's happened since then is the place I've been in and here in North Las Vegas, we had an opportunity, the property became available. So we jumped on it and we went ahead and bought it and we closed 2 weeks ago. So now the property is ours and now we can transform it exactly into what we want. I haven't had for going on 6 years a property large enough to hold a medicine lodge and hold the teachings, a place to do weekend teachings, which are basically indoor or outdoor, sitting at a table or sitting around a fire and talking about things like the medicine wheel, what an eagle feather is, what the pipe is, what the ceremonies are, why we do the ceremonies, how they came to be, how I came to be the caretaker of the lodge. This is a tradition, and Rainbow People's Medicine Lodge is an extension of a lodge which started back in California 6 generations ago. So this has been going on for a very, very, very long time. Long line of medicine teachers that I've had, and things have just progressed. I just happen to be one of the students that was in the right place at the right time to and be willing to do what was necessary. When grandfather or grandmother would call upon somebody to step up to do certain things, I was there. And as a result, I started getting more and more teachings than other people were getting. And eventually what wound up happening is grandfather retired from what he was doing. He became ill. Grandmother got up in age, and it was time for her to transition out and to worry about taking care of her own needs and not be worried so much as a group of people. And so she passed on the teachings. And as it turned out, I took all that information, wound up moving down into Pahrump, Nevada for a while. We had the lodge up and running for about 3 years and things were going really good. And then things just slowed off and then wound up moving out here into the metropolitan area of Las Vegas. And it's just taken the time that it's taken. And now is the right time for getting the lodge up and going again. I'm waiting on, as you know, a brother and sister to get into town. And then we are going to set the intention and what's going to happen with that. We'll set up the intention and we will actually build the lodge, the sweat lodge itself, and conduct the very first ceremony and set the intent for the next coming year. And that lodge will be up and running from that point on permanently. But the core people will be the core people that are closest to me that will be coming in to help me set the intention for that. We'll put the prayer ties into it. We'll put all the medicine into it and kick it off that way. And next month, we're starting off the lodge a little bit differently than I've done in the past. We're going to start off with conducting a monthly drumming circle. And it's just basically we're going to be using music to heal, using the heartbeat of the mother to get back in touch with who we really are instead of this false garbage that is out here that has been projected for so long. And Las Vegas is a mecca for just the unfathomable.
Yeah, given recent events, I say so.
But as far as my background goes, Blackfoot adopted into the Apache. Carrie Teachings also from the Cherokee people, which is also one of my bloodlines. So I'm kind of a Heinz 57 Native American, for lack of a better way of expressing it. Also carry Celtic bloodlines, and that is something that I'm working with a couple of other practitioners because of, for whatever reason, the powers that be chose to keep me away from that, and we'll get into that obviously in the second hour, but that was a part of my heritage that they wanted to keep me from for whatever reason. They felt that my being exposed to the Native American side would benefit them, so I got to be allowed to participate and learn all that I could. And thankfully, I've had that, because if it wasn't for those teachings and the core values that gave me, I don't know that I would have survived the other stuff that they put me through.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the Celtic tradition alongside the Native American. To me, the two do not seem distinct. I see huge overlaps in the cultures, and I see the culturally, they're both very close to the earth spirit.
Oh, yeah.
And even when you start to look at some of the lore in the background, there's some striking parallels between them. It's like they were either parallel cultures or cultures that diverged. I'm not sure, but I've always had this sense that there's something intertwining the Native American with specifically what we call the Celtic tradition.
Yeah. And is there anything specific you want me to go into as far as the lodge goes, as far as the history of it? And
I have a question before we get
sure.
to the lodge. Is it intention or by happenstance that you're choosing to do this in an area like Las Vegas?
This was actually the last place that I wanted to do this. It was my intention has been for a better part of 2 years now to get out of Las Vegas altogether. Actually, have a big pull for Pennsylvania, or at least that far on the East Coast. And that's what I was thinking, is that, okay, I'll just wait. We'll get there. Then I'll go for it. Well, turns out Creator's got plans that, you know, I wasn't aware of, and I'm along for the ride. So it didn't turn out that way. So we want now we have the property. We're transforming the backyard. We've transformed the inside of the house. It's our living space, but it's also now registered here in Nevada. We're registered as a quote unquote church, because that's Nevada state law.
Right. You have to, right.
And to protect myself when I do counseling work and one-on-one work, I had to be registered as an ordained minister, so I went through all that process and do that. Now, I can do everything in Nevada with the exception of conduct a wedding, and I'm not willing to go through the required hoops and that you'd have to do that and pay the fees. It's at this point, I think it cost me, I think, well, I checked into it a few months ago, it would be about $1,700 to get all the licensing for it.
Wow.
But when my mother passed away a few years ago, I was the one that conducted the ceremony for her, and it was all done legal. I was able to sign off on all the documents and everything like that. And so there are some advantages to it.
It dawns on me that, and Randy and I have discussed this a few times in recent shows, since Las Vegas has been hot on people's mind, that, you know, there's a reason that they chose to build the city of Las Vegas the way they did where they did. Mm-hmm. Some of the same elements that lie in the ground there could also be conducive going the other way to something spiritual and whatnot. And, you know, they're unfortunately using the sort of the natural potential of the place and the frequency of the place to do something destructive, but it's still natural energy and natural potential, and it can be taken the other way. And it dawns on me that it, you know, at this time in particular, I mean, it's been for a long time, but especially now, that area needs a different kind of balance to the energy.
And then with obviously the recent events that have just taken place here, it's become more apparent to me that we're exactly where we need to be, doing exactly what we need to be doing, and the time is ripe for doing this. Like you said, it's in dire need of the other side of the spiritual aspect of it, which it doesn't have. It's got the sin and chaos and drama and all the obvious stuff that comes with it. And yeah, maybe, just maybe, we can plant a few seeds and offset, and maybe we can twist that energy to going back in the right direction rather than this backward energy that is here.
Yes.
And so that's the hope. You know, I try to look at it from the perspective, okay, this is not what I intended. This is not what I actually wanted, but this is what needs to happen. And I'm just a tool for creators, so I'm going to do what I'm told to do. And that's what I've been doing for quite a while. I mean, I sit on a couple different councils, not just a Native American council. I sit on a Nordic Celtic council. And I'm a lower echelon in that particular council, but that's okay. You know, we're...
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I figured that was going to happen. So we got to freeze up.
Yeah,
let's see if he comes back.
Let's see.
I'm going to pause the recording.
Okay. Or something. I don't know what you want to call it. We lost Bear for a minute, but he's back. And I think where we were at, we were talking about you know, your work, you ending up in Las Vegas, even though that wasn't your intention, and, you know, sort of working to reverse or, you know, correct or heal some of the energies and the misuse of that going on there. So... carrying on from there.
Okay. God, I lost track of where I was at.
Well, for anybody that doesn't know, we were knocked off for almost 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went and checked out there. There's a van out in front. They're having their fun, so.
Okay, good. Hey, guys.
Yeah. Hi.
Have a coffee. Relax.
Oh, God. But anyway, you know, the whole transition with the lodge has been an ongoing metamorphosis, for lack of a better way of putting it, and it's really been a wonderful thing. I've got students in Puerto Rico, Guam, New Zealand. And I wouldn't even really I don't like to use the term students anymore, because they're practitioners in their own right. All I did was rough off some of the rough edges and give them a little bit, some tools and teachings that they didn't necessarily quite have. And I've got one that she's off and running now, and she's working with plant medicine primarily in Puerto Rico. And it's, I just heard back from her finally after the disaster down there. And, wonderful, just the things that are going on. I mean, we never know where the seeds are going to actually grow. It's just my job just to throw the seeds out there and let them plant and flourish where they go. And it's not up to me. It's just been an incredible journey. The everything about the lodge has been, and those teachings, like I was saying before we got so rudely interrupted, was. Tools that I've been able to use to pull myself out of the muck and mire and the garbage and come back up out of the sludge. And I think for a better person overall.
Can you just, for the audience and for us as well, like, tell us about, like, if somebody comes to you to for healing or for instruction or to do a sweat or whatever, what kind of things do you do, go through with them? What kind of practices and sort of what that is?
Well, first and foremost, I get a feel for the individual. I usually do a one-on-one counseling and just spend an hour or two with them and get to know them, get to know their background, where they've been, what they've... Okay, so you're coming to me for this. Why? What drew you to me? What is it about what I'm doing or that you think that I can offer that is calling to you? And ask probing questions, kind of like, you know, like you guys do as journalists. You want to get to the meat and potatoes. Okay, you're going there, but you're not quite there. So here, let me guide you a little bit more and take you a little bit deeper. And basically do the same thing. And find out what it is they've been through. And of course, like the last gentleman we had a few months ago, he came with what he thought was quote unquote a soul attachment. Well, as it turned out, it wasn't. It was an actual physical medical condition that he was dealing with. So sent him to the professionals, and we did some of the work and crystal work and healing work on him, but he actually needed more than that. Turns out he was dealing with some other issues that I couldn't really address. They weren't necessarily spiritual issues per se. And if that turns out to be the case, you know, by all means, here you go. And with what I do, I know there's a lot of teachers and practitioners out there that charge exuberant amounts of money. And come to me for a weekend. It's only going to cost you $500. We'll give you the sweat lodge. We'll do this. We'll do that. And you're going to walk away richer for it. Well, no, you're not. You're going to walk away with your pocketbook being depleted and not really gaining anything of any value that's of any use to anybody. And I don't do that. I don't charge a dime for anything I do. I never have. And I don't see the point of it. The teachings came to me freely. I paid dearly for what I have. But everything comes around in different ways. I've got people that come, and the lodge is self-supporting. So if you want what we have, I'll provide the space for it. Bring something to support it. That means bringing food to share. That means we always need people come. They use the restroom. Bring toilet paper. Bring paper towels, bring paper plates, bring something for what you're getting. And that's kind of the way it's been. I think that's what separates what we do versus what like a lot of the Tony Robbins and people like that do. And or the Corey Goods and the rest of those cornflakes. They just, you know, you pay a couple hundred dollars for a weekend seminar listening to these. Got to be nice. I'm on radio.
Actually, you don't. You're on off planet radio.
Find upstanding individuals talk out the side of their necks. And I'm all about, okay, you want to learn about this. Well, I'm here to teach teachers. Each person I work with, regardless of what walk of life they come from, you're a teacher in your own right. We're all students. We're all teachers. We all have something to give, and we all have something to learn. And that's kind of the methodology that goes through my mind. And as far as the one-on-one, like I said, I try to get a feel for the person, what they've been through, what teachings have they had any teachings? Okay, if you've been exposed to Native American spirituality, in what aspect? What was your teacher like? What is the lineage of your teachings? Where does it come from? Do you know the history? Because there should be a lineage that you can go back and trace where this person came from, where they learned from, where their teachers learned from. And in my case, I have all that information, which is wonderful. And I think that also gives somebody a sense of security, a sense of knowing. It's like you're not just going to some pseudo person. Like, unfortunately, I'm going to use him again. A David Wilcox or a Corey Good, you know the person, you know where they're coming from, you know what their background is, you know all that aspect as far as that stuff goes. So, and I think that that's important. You need to be able, especially with spiritual matters, you need to be able to give a historical background of where your stuff came from. Like in my case, it goes back six generations. It didn't just come out of a hat. I didn't learn it in a book. Everything I've learned is firsthand knowledge, and I've learned from some of the last actual quote unquote full blooded Native Americans that there were out there. And a lot of my teachers were also mixed medicine. That's where a lot of the Celtic and Druidic and Viking teachings come from. It's an eclectic. I'm not full blooded. I don't have full blooded Lakota traditions to fall back on. It's a very eclectic pot from which I pull the medicine from. But as far as the actual traditions of like each ceremony that I carry, that I teach, there is a very specific thing that goes, and those things are kept pure and in order in the way that they were given. That is the way that it is taught. And if you are going to do this down the road, there are years and years and years that you have to go through to learn how to pour water for the sweat lodge. To be a sweat leader it's not something that anybody wants to just dive in and do. You'll take a chance on killing people, as we saw happen a few years back in Sedona. And I was on the board of directors that went down and talked and had to counteract what that individual did. And
tell folks about that incident.
I'm sorry, what?
Tell folks about that incident.
Oh, God. What was that? That was a 96, 90, 98. No, that was 98 back now, wasn't it, I think.
I vaguely remember this, but I don't have any details.
It's been long enough now that I don't remember all the specifics of it. But basically what he did is he took his book knowledges. He had been writing a lot of self-help books, and he was a self-help guru. I forgot the gentleman's name at this point. He took people down into Sedona. They went into a secluded area. He built a huge sweat lodge. They put chains and locks on sweat lodge doors, so people were actually locked in there and they could not get out.
Wow.
And that's just stuff that you don't do. And what wound up happening, because they didn't know what they were doing, they overheated people in a desert environment in the middle of summer, and people died.
What on earth would be the reason for locking somebody in? That doesn't make any sense.
I don't think he ever came forward with a logical explanation as to why they did that. So unfortunately I don't have an answer. I wish I did. But those are just things you just don't do. And this is really a calling. It's not something that I went seeking. It's not something that I actually wanted. In fact, when I was very young and I was first told this is going to be your path, I ran. I wanted no part of it. It scared the living hell out of me. But it's like a peeling of the onion. You always come back to where you start from, and there's always more lessons to learn. And you're not done with it until you're done with it. And it just turned out.
Can I ask what may be like a very silly, basic question, but as a question probably some of the listeners have, and I do, I've never done a sweat. I know a little bit about them, but like, what is the purpose? Like, what is the benefit? What is the, what would be the reason that somebody like me would want to do a sweat?
Consider the sweat lodge the womb of Mother Earth. So you go into the lodge and you're coming out to be reborn. So you go in with all the garbage that you carry as an adult, and you come out purified from all that garbage, and you get to dump it. It's a way to cleanse. It's a way to cleanse and purify your spirit. Reconnect with what really matters: earth, trees, stones, the wind, birds, the animal kingdoms, the mineral kingdoms, and bring and incorporate that back into your life and get more earth-based, what we used to be like prior to all the technology and everything else. If you want to get back in balance, get out of the UV lights, get out of the artificial lights like I have in the room, like you guys have in your room right now. Take your sleeping bag out, sleep on top of Mother Earth, and you'll ground back out. If you want to get back in sync, get back in touch with nature. The nature's from where we came, and nature's to where we will return. So it makes sense. If you want to get back in tune, where are you going to go? You're not going to go to Radio Shack. You're going to go to Mother Earth. You're going to go back out to nature. Go spend a day out hiking. Go spend a day out fishing. Go spend a day out sitting by a tree, listening. Just listening to the wind, watching the animals, and see how you feel afterwards. Generally speaking, if I'm having an off day, take off my shoes and socks, go sit out in the grass, and reconnect. Yeah. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm all for hugging trees and laying flat on the dirt and all that. I mean, I literally, people laugh at me sometimes when I'm on my walk, because I'll just see a tree and I'll decide that I want to go hug that tree, and I will go there and walk around the tree, and people laugh and I don't care. But there is a connection that happens. Like, I always like to sort of close my eyes when I'm doing everything and kind of see what happens in the back, and you can energetically see the electricity that happens when you make contact with your body and you sort of merge with the tree. There is a palpable fusion that sort of takes place.
And I also work with a lot of people that deal with a lot of addiction in all of its different forms. How do you break the cycle? Well, here again, reconnect to what and who you really are. Do you know who you are? How do I do that? Well, I'm not Native American. Can I do this? If you are called to this, you're called to it. It doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter. And my teacher was very specific. He told me, and she told me, both of them, grandmother and grandfather, both told me the same thing at the same time, as a matter of fact. Said that there's going to be a point in time where you're going to be called upon to teach. And when they come, you will teach. That's it. Didn't say anything about race, color, or creed. Because none of that matters. It's what's in here. It's what your soul is. It's what your soul calls to. If you're called to this, I will be there. And it doesn't matter to me what your ethnic background is. It doesn't matter to me what your educational background is. Because ultimately, all of that is superficial anyway. So what is real? Well, what is tangible? Spirit is tangible. Our soul is tangible. Our soul is everlasting. This vessel is eventually going to give way and go bye-bye.
Yep.
But my soul will continue on into the next phase. And then the next phase after that, whatever comes after that. Third, fourth, fifth level ascension. And, you know, we're all in that time period. We're starting to see all the chaos and everything getting drummed up. But we're also starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel where we're going to ascend to a higher level and a higher level of existence where we aren't going to need these physical meat suits anymore. You know, this is false. This isn't real. What's inside and who my soul is, that's what's real. The soul that you have, that's what's real. We can connect from here in North Las Vegas. I can connect with Emily up in Northern California like that, you know, and given the right circumstances.
No, you can't. No, you can't. Because I'm in Southern California, so you can't.
I had it wrong.
I'm fucking with you.
But
when my bilocation skills are on point, then you'll be able to connect with me.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm kidding. Sorry to distract, but I thought that was
That's
fun.
Okay. You know, I'm willing to go wherever we need to go and wherever is appropriate. Let's just go. Let's just take this.
I have one more question about where we were at. So you said like a lot of people come to you with like addiction issues and whatever. Like I know people in my life who've done sweat lodges as part of trying to come off of drugs or alcohol or, you know, even, you know, eating issues and whatever. So is that like the idea just basically that all those toxins and then all of the sort of spiritual imprint that is like on those toxins in your body have built up, and by sweating that out, that gives you an opportunity to sort of.
I think it helps a lot, especially when you're talking of like alcoholism or drug addiction in particular. That's part of the process. You have to get rid of the toxins that are in the body before you can. And that's one way to pull them out. I think it's an easier, softer way than possibly going to a detox center. Yeah. Where they put you on pharmaceutical medications, which also have their own side effects and drawbacks to it. So this is a more natural way to come off of some of those things. And maybe you're lost. You're a spiritual individual, but you don't know where you quite fit in. Well, here's something that you can latch onto. Maybe this isn't your calling, but this gives you a foundation from which to build. You know, well, I'm really drawn to crystals. Well, I teach crystal healing. Let's go for it. What do you want to learn? What do you want to know? I think it, the lodge in itself offers just one single pathway to opening up several other doors, you know, and like people come to me and they say, well, you can see right through me. You can see what I can't see. No, I can look in a door, but it's the door that you open. It's your door. All you have to do is be willing to turn around and look, and you can see inside that door too. So that's what I teach people. Look inside the door yourself. I'll teach you how to look inside the door that you're asking me to look into. I can see what you're asking for, but I'm going to teach you how to do it. Rather than come to me, and it's like, well, you can make millions of dollars, Barry, if you just take people's money and give them all this information. It's like, yeah, I could. But then I got to live the karma of that. I'd rather teach somebody how to do what I do. I'd rather see somebody do what I do more successfully, do it better. You know, I hope to see, and I've got one student that has taken off in a full-fledged run, and what she has going now is far beyond anything I could have ever dreamed up. And that's her calling, and that's awesome. She's teaching the sweat lodge. She's teaching the medicine wheel. And she's got all these people that are coming to her. And I'm like, that is wonderful. She goes, I don't know what to do. I don't have any more free time. You got all the free time in the world. You're doing something that you love. You're doing something that calls to you. And you're doing it in the right way. And you're getting your needs met. Your bills are paid. You have a roof over your head. You're eating every day. What more could you possibly want or need? You know, and this is not for the faint of heart. And the medicine path is definitely not for the faint of heart. And I wouldn't recommend it from the perspective of what I do for just anybody. This was a no holds barred. I made an agreement. And when I made that agreement, it was for life. It's not something I can walk away from. As a brother of ours that you both know very well, who's been incognito for quite a while now, but he's said it in several of the radio talks that he's done. You know, I made an agreement when I walked away and I awakened from the whole MK Ultra reality. And my agreement was that I would fight for humanity. I won't fight for the cabal. I won't fight for the global elite. I will fight to exterminate what they have perpetrated. And that's what I stand for. And, that commitment's for life. The medicine path is not something that I don't play Indian. This is who I am. This is what I live. This is my day to day existence. This is all I do. And, without it, and a part of me would be, there would be a part of me that would be missing at this point.
I'm wondering if you could maybe talk about this a little bit, because part of your own journey kind of connects this healing path with you dealing with your own background. So talk a little bit about, I use the term soul retrieval. There's a lot of different concepts that are baked into that essentially it has to do with bringing back in the core. And I'm not just even talking about survivors of black ops programs. I'm talking about many people who have been through traumatic issues of being able to reclaim the inner place, the place that it's kind of like what we were as children. It was kind of that untouched place that seems like it got fractured, fragmented, fouled, violated in a thousand different ways in the course of life, whether it was in secret program or relationship or just the normal course way through life. So how do you integrate what you do with your own healing path?
Well, you know very well after, you know, us getting to know each other and knowing a lot of what I've been through personally and kind of walking with me through that journey up to this point. There's no easy answer to this. It's an ongoing thing. I mean, there's new stuff and new doors that break down all the time. And integration is a constant thing that's still happening for me. I don't have all the pieces. I don't know that I ever will. The compartmentalization that they do to you is horrendous. And the way that they go about doing it is even worse. Torture, drugs. And I'm not saying anything that it's not already known and out there that you guys have talked about in the past. When the opportunity presents itself, though, now I have an opportunity. Okay, I'm not feeling right. What's going on? I now have a pathway by which to kind of guide myself to an understanding and to come to a decisive conclusion as to, okay, this is what happened. Okay, I think this is what happened, and then diving into it more and being able to clearly have a pathway to walk down, to navigate to, okay, this is a false memory versus this is a real memory. Now, how do I combine and integrate the two of those so that I have a truth? That's a bitch.
See, that actually is the labyrinth that I think most of us walk. You're the extreme edge of it. Survivors are the extreme edge of it. But somewhere in the middle of the continuum, most people, and Emily and I have talked about this, this sense of broken frames, like parts of our lives that have been cut out, like film. And you have the sense that there's something there that doesn't belong there, and also something that's missing that was taken out.
Well, you know, when I started diving into it, like in one instance, I started diving back. It's like I had all these memories of summers being in a particular place in Southern California that never existed. It does not exist. It never did exist. It wasn't real.
Where did you think you were?
A place called Camp Woodchuck. And the camp never existed. The place never existed. Yeah. It wasn't real.
Where did you think this was?
Somewhere near Anza Borrego, in the Anza Borrego desert area.
That's interesting. You know, it's interesting. So when you say it doesn't exist, are you saying that you can't find any evidence that it existed, or that you're, is that what you're saying?
This
is going to be, we've had this conversation.
Okay, hold on. I haven't had this conversation with him, so let me have it with him. Okay, so you're saying that, like, you have memories of being there, memories of things that went on, and you went looking for evidence of it, and you can't find any evidence that it ever existed, or your parents told you that you didn't go there, or what? How is it that you're, like, what exactly do you mean?
One of the things that was a big red flag for me was that no photographs, supposedly, you know, summer vacations and this, that, and the other, there are sets of photographs where I know that, okay, we were there together as a supposed family, and these things were real. These are actual bona fide real Kodak photographs. I can verify that this was actually done on film, and I can see the date on it. I can go back, and if I really wanted to, in some instances, okay, 1979, this photograph was taken here, and here's a verified place. Here's a monument. Here's something that verifies that this place actually exists. Now, I've gone back in the records in California extensively, and Camp Woodchuck did not exist.
So you have pictures of this place that you thought was Camp Woodchuck, but when you go looking for Camp Woodchuck, you can't find it.
Exactly.
Okay, so the only reason I ask is because I had a very similar thing happen in that, like, this camp that I went to when I was younger that was not just very close to my house. I tried certain, I had bizarre things go on for me there. My dad remembers me going there. He took me there every day and whatever. But when I did a search on the internet, I couldn't find anything either. I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find any reference to it. I couldn't find, you know, Facebook has a group for everything. People who used to go to the ranch club, people who used to go to Camp Woodchuck, couldn't find any of that stuff, couldn't find anything at all. But I searched many times. Finally, one time I had my dad search, and he was able to find one thing, and it was like an around the way reference. And the only reason he even understood that it was that was because he remembered that he knew the person that ran the camp. And so this was something that came up with that person's name in it, but really no reference to the camp, right? So I sometimes wonder if these things are obviously possibly being buried online, but in particular, maybe specifically being buried for those of us who would go looking for them. So if somebody else goes and looks, they might find something, right? Somebody who has no connection to you or none of this weird stuff. I think there are different internets. I think different internets exist for all of us. But I, that's it, it's one of the most odd and fascinating things of this journey, isn't it?
Yes, you heard it here first, folks. There are many internets. Remember this.
There are many summer camps and there are many internets.
There are many summer camps and there are many experiences.
Yes. And this is not the reality you're looking for.
I knew instantly when Bear said that story what you were thinking, Emily, because we've had that conversation before.
Yeah. So this Camp Woodchuck, what is it, like a place you went with your family, or was it a summer camp you went to individually and then would go back to your family
supposedly
after?
It was a summer camp that boys went to. Mm-hmm. What I found out since is that I did come across one photograph, which unfortunately I wasn't quick enough to download it. I went into my adoptive father's page before he shut me out. And he had a picture of him with me in front of this place. Well, it turns out it wasn't what I thought it was. The place that the photograph was actually taken, because I was able to go back and through the archives and look it up, was the Presidio. And
okay.
That's pretty intense.
That's super interesting. So you thought the camp was in Southern California, and you thought this was a picture of you at the camp, but the picture was a picture of you at the Presidio in Northern California.
Correct.
That's fascinating. So now my question next would be, was there any kind of, were you able to find any records of any camp near the Presidio?
Not a one.
The only reason I'm asking this is because, so for me, the camp that I went to backs right up against Rocketdyne and Spawn Ranch in Chatsworth in Southern California, right? So the thing that we could have thought was a summer camp was really just like a backdoor entrance to those things, right? So I'm wondering if there was some sort of faux summer camp being run somewhere around the Presidio that was just like, oh yeah, I'm dropping my kid off at, you know, Camp Woodchuck or whatever, but it was really going to the Presidio. But in a kid's mind, especially if they're spending, you know, long periods of time there, and you're a little kid, if you're in the car for a couple of hours or whatever, or even just, you know, kids don't have the same sense of reference for like space and time that you have as an adult. You know, do you think that there could be anything like that where they were just telling you were going to Camp Woodchuck, but you were going to Presidio?
That's what I've come to understand is most likely probable as to what actually took place in my particular case.
Yeah. Okay. So what went on at Camp Woodchuck?
You've probably in the course of the years you guys have been doing this, and it's specifically with regards to MK Ultra, I've heard the term the chair.
Okay.
Now, I spend a lot of time in a device that we refer to as the chair, hooked up to electrodes and IV drips and fun little cocktails, LSD mixed with other things to bring about what they wanted to bring about and break down the psyche along with electrical torture and the rest of it that comes with it. And, so what I thought was Camp Woodchuck was Camp Whore. And I was just recently talking to Randy about this a few weeks ago, that these are relatively fresh memories that are obviously still a bit on the painful side to deal with, but that's okay. I just happened to catch
my wife. I'm feeling what you're feeling. I'm feeling an extreme amount of pressure.
Yeah. No, this is...
My wife just happened to catch something on YouTube, and she was watching it because she was really into the Kathy O'Brien story. Mm-hmm. Well, the next video that popped up happened to be a little excerpt on retired Colonel...
Michael Aquino.
Yeah.
I just happened to walk in a room. I didn't hear the name. I turned around and I looked at the image on a TV set, and I literally started throwing up. She said, Jesus, did you eat something? What's wrong with you? I said, this individual, this sick individual, I know him. I remember him. The long ass eyebrow that he had. I mean, just one freaky, nasty, vile individual. And it just blows me away the level of protection people, scumbags like this, have had around them, that they're able to be allowed in a free world to continue doing whatever the crap and vileness that they're doing. And after getting sick, I of course got extremely angry and upset, and didn't sleep that night, obviously. And the next day, when I was able to start formulating words, she sat down with me, because she's good at that, and she's really good at keeping me grounded. And we were able to start slowly, and I've got John Storm here, so I've started sitting down with him, and he said, like, okay, let me go through and let me do some research on this, and let me bring up some images, and we're going to sit down, and this might be tough. So we sat down, and they brought up some images, and it's, okay, I want you to look at these and tell me what you feel. Well, I started recognizing the buildings, and then I started recognizing the hallways, and then I was describing the hallways, and then I was describing the room numbers. Then I could pretty much map out the layout of the entire place at the Presidio where we were, and it wasn't on the ground level floor. It was a basement level, and all matters of horror and horrific things were taking place down there. And like I was telling Randy a few weeks ago, I thought at first that the connection I was seeing and the images I was seeing was a place up in upstate New York, which was Camp Hero. Never was there, thankfully. As far as I know, wasn't a bona fide member of the Montauk Project, which I'm glad for.
But all of these projects were connected. Montauk was one pivot specifically on the East Coast, and then you had numerous operations that took place through the Southwest, going up into north, probably into Washington State, and even further into Canada. There were centers to all of this. I mean, you had more players, scientists, and different laboratories, but they were running parallel experiments. The chair was the big one.
And I know the term is out there, and it's what most people would probably associate it with, but for the sake of this conversation, I'll use it. But I don't understand. It's not a term I personally adopt for myself, but the Presidio is one of the major places where they were adopting and changing their program for the so-called super soldier program. Mm-hmm. And in my case, the assassination program, which was and still is MK Delta. And that is all that program is. It's all about assassination, wet work. It's all black ops. You're trained as trained to do that. That's what you're trained for. That's it. You're not there to play patty cake or make nice with anybody or be a negotiator. You're there to be trained to be the tool that they need to, remove their opposition and remove them so that they can further their agenda. And that's just kind of the way that program is. I don't know how much you really want me to go into the aspect of that, because a lot of it is just downright violent. And
I don't think we need to go into the gruesome details. I think people get the sense of where this was going. Emily, do you have a question?
No, you just addressed it. That's fine. I was going to say basically what you said. You know, so there may be some people. I mean, you did a little bit of an explanation there. There may be some people in the audience. We do have a lot of new listeners, and you know, but also a lot of our listeners are very familiar with that there are different kinds of MK programs, but MK Delta isn't spoken about as often. So without getting into the gruesomes of it, can you give us a little bit more details on what exactly MK Delta is? Like, everyone's really obviously very familiar with MK Ultra.
Yeah.
And people are, you know, know about MK often and you know, MK's, you know, search and things like that. But what can you tell us a little bit more about MK Delta?
Different sub programs. I mean, I got tested out for work in Monarch, which obviously wasn't my forte. I don't have the personality for it to be a play toy, but it started out with, first and foremost, you know, talking with Duncan, I come to the same conclusion at the same time, at least in one period back in those days, we were in the same place at the same time going through Project Talent, where they basically were looking for what are you good at? What are you adapted for? Well, spiritual adaptation, and I carry the genes which were naturally calling for that. Native American bloodline, Celtic bloodline, naturally adaptable to all things supernatural, and it just worked for me. One of the fortes I carry with me is the astral projection, and being able to do that pretty much at the drop of a dime whenever I want, and be able to travel wherever I want, see whatever I want. Wonderful tool if it's, and wonderful for the powers that be to find out about their enemies, what they're doing, what they're planning, where they're planning it, how they're planning it, and being able to pull the information, bring the information back and give them a decisive map. Okay, well, such and such is going to be at such and such place at such and such time. Well, then they can send in an operative to take the person out or do whatever they're going to do. Later on, being trained more in soldiering aspects, and what eventually wound up being that I found out is MK Delta, which was all government wet work and working for all things spooky and being an expendable. The last job I was supposed to be on, which is what led to some of the legal problems I'm now still dealing with the aftermath of, I broke down and I was no longer able to be activated. And when they tried to activate me, they tried to activate the self-destruct, which almost worked, but it didn't. And I'm still here. And as a result, I've now know exactly where at least half a dozen of the implants are. Definitely have one here, one in the back of the neck, palm of the hand. Typical spots that most people talk about. And I've had those things verified. Of course, I don't take my own word for it. I worked with Duncan on a few things to get some things vetted and verified. It's like, because I told Duncan early on, it's like, you know, if it ever comes to the point where I come out and I come forward, well, I want to make darn sure that, number one, it's truthful, it's honest, and it's something that somebody can go back and say, hey, you know, Bear, you said this at such and such date, at such and such time. Okay, but here's the information that you can verify what I said, and you can vet it, and you don't have to take my word for it. So people that have already been there and done that and have gone through that process. And I mean, Randy, you know real well that, you know, especially with Duncan and Storm, they don't take anybody's word at any value. They're going to go through your background. They're going to go through your history before you're allowed in that inner circle for any reason. And I was no exception to that rule. My saving grace was the person that was there first and foremost, who helped me to come to grips and come to terms with what is, was David Corso before he passed away.
Yep.
And
we know you're out there, Pops.
You know, as much of a anal cavity as he could possibly be,
and would freely admit as much.
I'm very grateful for him being there when he was. I mean, there's no mistaking. And Dave, if he was here, be the first one to admit that, hey, yeah, I'm an asshole. And this is who I am. You can take it or leave it. I really don't give a damn.
Oh, I've got him on record saying that. I actually have a recording of him saying exactly that.
But by all means, you know, yeah, I am, obviously I'm a little bit unnerved and a little bit uncomfortable, but I'm okay. So,
well, what we're going to do right now, since we're bumping right up on the first hour, is I think we'll take a break, catch a breath, get a drink, smoke a cigarette, do all the necessary things and round this off and come back on the second hour, which is a special segment. And we'll do that when we come back on the other side of Off Planet Radio, Off Planet TV. We'll be back in a few minutes, or we'll be on the other channel.
This is Off Planet Radio.
Welcome back. We're now in the Patrons Hour, and I'm here with my co-host, Randy Mulligan, and Medicine Bear White Bow has been our guest, and we will continue in the second hour. And Randy, take it away.
Oh, no pressure there. Well, first off, let me say
that. Bring it back, then. If you can't take it away, just bring it back.
No, let me just say, it's kind of cool to hear you say patrons only. Actually, this will be public on the Patreon site. And so the idea is to bring people over to see the site. And so it's a limited distribution. You're not getting this on YouTube. And
at least not at this point, at some point.
At least not, right, exactly. We're still working through a lot of the vagaries of how all this is going to work, what we're going to release publicly and what we're going to release to the patrons. But the patrons get this kind of material first. And we think that's important because that's the discerning audience and those are the people that support us. And if you're seeing this and you're not, consider. So we are back with Medicine Bear. We kind of launched into some things in the last 20 minutes or so of the last segment that dovetail into the deeper, darker aspects of your present, future, past, because it all flows together. And really, you know, I think anybody that's working through trauma on any levels dealing with their present, future, past, because there's a time distortion that occurs as a result of being in these programs. In fact, you were talking earlier about Montauk and about the chair and some of the things that that produces, one of them being advanced states of astral projection. So maybe to unwrap it for this hour, Bear, let's talk a little bit about what you do remember as a child and the experience's impact on you, both in terms of what you remember now and what you have gleaned of the experiences being a child in that environment, both the parallel sense of normalcy and the knowing that there was the something that sat out there on the edge that just didn't quite compute.
Well, I mean, and the first time that we were talking about all of this to begin with, I kind of brought some of it forward a little bit, and maybe I can solidify some of those things that probably went left unanswered in the first time that we did this. And if I don't, I apologize. And if there's any questions or concerns about anything anybody wants, I'm available to be reached at any time, and I'm open to talk, especially with the small group of people that are connected with Randy and Emily and what they've got going. I'm open to those people. But at any rate, the adoptive family that I was adopted into, I have since found out the grandparents that I knew, it's a little sketchy. The last name for them is Rosine, and the grandfather was CEO of Max Factor way back in the day. They're attached to one of the 13 families, original 13, so-called special 13 families, an offset of that. Now, I think it's Rosenberg or it may be Rothschild. I'm not exactly sure.
But the Jewish.
Yeah. So that's where that tied into my, now the adoptive mother that I had was an adopted child for them, and she was a program baby herself. I don't have any contact with any of them anymore, and haven't for over 20 years. And I don't foresee that ever changing. In fact, last time that there was a interaction, it was a phone conversation. And what I got on the other end is, "Oh, you're not dead yet." And hung up on. And that was the last attempt about 15 years ago that I made to try and actually have contact and try to get some resolution and stuff. And it's not going to come that way. And I've come to terms with that. The grandparents in question, I was the bastard grandchild. I was the, I was there to be abused. Going over for weekends at their place would result in her taking out the cereal boxes out of the oven that she had, which was, at that time, I guess I must not have been, I wasn't a very big kid to begin with, but, I would start out my weekend pulling out the cereal boxes out of the oven. She'd pull the oven racks out of the oven, and I'd have to get into the oven, and she'd close the door, and I'd be in there for a couple hours, and not knowing whether or not she was going to turn it on, always with the threat of it being turned on and being cooked. And that's kind of how my childhood was. So a lot of abuse, a lot of verbal abuse, a lot of physical abuse, a lot of torture, and all of it by design and all of it with a purpose in mind. And as a end result, the inevitable happened. And my psyche made a choice at that point. It was either die or split and survive. And apparently what I did was decided to split and survive. And, you know, that made me a viable tool for inevitably being used in the programs. Now, we all know that at this point, it's no secret that the elite and the families and the offshoots of these bloodlines all find it a wonderful thing to take children that are brought into the world and send them to the form of the process of being broken down and being split into half alternate personalities. And, you know, this is a wanted thing, a desired thing. I have no doubt that Bill Clinton is one of those end results. Looking at some of the older interviews from when he was the president and such, it's very apparent that he was broken down.
That interview with Larry King is crazy, where he's just completely an alter. Just real quick, I have to go back to, I'm still stuck on the spot where the Jewish grandmother puts the child in the oven. So aren't you, like, I'm Jewish as well, so like this is not, you know, like, they supposedly suffered a Holocaust where their people were put in the oven, and she's putting you in the oven.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time dragging my...
Oh, this is also the same grandmother that my adoptive sister and I, we were taken out for a special treat. We were taken to Baskin Robbins, bought each a ice cream cone. And I remember we got to the door and we were exiting the ice cream parlor, and the door bumped into me and the top of my ice cream plopped over onto the ground. She snagged a cone out of my hand, scooped it up off the ground and said, "You will eat it. I paid for it. You're going to eat it." Of course, it was all covered with dirt and muck and places where people had walked and spit on the ground and everything. And I was forced to eat it. And that's how I got treated. I was an adopted child. I was Native American, so I'm already a heathen. And I'm only good for one thing and one thing only, to be a slave. And that's how I was viewed. And the term that I grew up with that I now know is associated specifically with MK Ultra is the chosen one. You were the chosen one. And growing up thinking that actually meant something meaningful. Well, it meant something meaningful, right? Just not to me.
Were you the oldest?
Yes.
Of course. Yeah.
And the actual blood-related grandchildren all got treated well and got decent things. I got hand-me-down clothes. I got hand-me-down everything. Christmas gifts were stuff that was left over that maybe the other grandchildren didn't want, so they'd rebox it up and, well, here you go, you can have this kind of things. Like, well, we don't want to deny him a Christmas, but, you know, he's not really deserving of the full-fledged thing, so here we go. Hence my disdain for all things holiday related. It doesn't resonate for me. I don't have good experiences from that. And what few I do have been tainted with so much other garbage and vileness that I've had to develop a sense of family in adult life. I don't remember having a sense of attachment to anything when I was growing up, at least not anything that was positive. So that answers that, I think.
You know, you just brought something to the surface. I'll try and get this out. Obviously, the abuse that you underwent was horrific. It was cruel. It clearly resulted in your fractures, which then led to initiation into a program. I don't think most people realize, though, you talked there about Christmas. This is something that sits under the surface because I notice a commonality with people who have been through these types of experiences. They generally do not like specifically Christmas. Many of us don't celebrate birthdays. I try to avoid it. The externalization of our sensory systems. This goes back again to childhood. It's a really hard concept to verbalize. It's working through my head. So the whole Christmas thing to me was like an engineered social mind control operation. Whoa, what was that?
It's just one of those things. I'm okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
I don't have any control over it. It's
okay.
You're part of the brain injury.
I was just wondering if you got hit.
No.
You were just getting hit.
No, I'm not getting hit. It's just a little bit of anxiety. I'm okay though.
Okay. Are you sure?
Yeah.
It's just, okay.
I'd go through, this is what I live with.
So, when you're talking about your experiences, I'm remembering specifically, and Emily, maybe you saw it too, the Svali material that came out years ago.
I'm not super familiar with the Svali material. Like, I might not identify it as that name, but if you can detail it.
Okay, it was basically a book that was written by an ex-Illuminati family member on how the families worked in mind controlling the children. Specifically children inside of Illuminati families, but we all know that there's different structures, different paradigms for how this operates. I mean, there's people that are brought in from the outside. There's chosen ones that, as we've talked about before, were profiled coming in.
Yes.
You know, and this is the hardest part for people to understand is that, yes, this has to do with genetics and bloodlines because they knew what bloodlines you were being mapped to when you were coming back into physicality, the incarnation.
The tracking of frequency and then aligning that frequency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Find in a certain body and genetics. Were you going?
In my case, I think it's some very interesting dynamics because when I was being brought up, I was being brought up with the ritualistic aspects of things that the Illuminists do. And all things demonic. I mean, I'm very well versed in the dark arts. That's what I was brought up and trained with at first. All things satanic. I mean, Black Bible was in the house. What I thought was the Star of David wasn't the Star of David.
Right.
And it sat on the wall. And there was an altar in the house. Black candles. I mean, you name the garbage that was in there, and it was there. They had the athames. They had all that garbage that was there. And she would claim, my adoptive mother would claim to be a kitchen witch. Well, she was a witch, all right, but not by any means of kitchen or otherwise, but all things dark arts. And ritualistic, you know, sacrificing, being exposed to that kind of horrific shit and seeing it happen. My first experience with death was an animal. My first human experience with death wasn't in the military like most people think, with an extensive military background that I have. I was 7 or 8 years old, and we were pitted against each other. And in my group of 1,000, we got broke down into a group of 500, and then broken down even further for training purposes and hand-to-hand combat. And it was a match to the death. I won. I walked away. He didn't. I don't know what happened to the rest of those children. I don't know where they are. I don't know how many of them survived. I know I did. I know I got farmed out and started working extensively with military programs and military personnel and Aquino and the rest of these scumbags and other military officials. And so after a short period of time, I don't remember the other children. I remember them at first, but don't ask me faces. Don't ask me to recall. Right. I just remember the gray uniforms, the gray sweats. And, it wasn't uncommon for, okay, well, here's the hand-to-hand, here's the knife-to-hand, hand-to-hand combat. Do what you've been shown to do. And at that point, you have a choice. You either do it or you're just severely beaten or worse. And I didn't particularly care for beatings. So when it came to time to do what I had to do, I went to the extreme, and I was good at it. It's the only reason why I'm still here. I'm not proud of it, looking back on it. It horrifies me to think back that early on I was exposed to that and the level of depravity that it takes to put a child through that kind of thing. I mean, these are some sick people we're talking about here. Sorry to cut in on you like that, Randy.
No, that was actually a great wraparound response. I think where I was going with that was if we go back just a minute to the holidays thing. The more I've studied these holidays, and specifically how children are targeted, has a lot to do with mind control operations, because the holidays are designed to pull you. You think about some of your earliest memories. Now, this is true on a universal level because we have these days we celebrate and they're ritualistic. But here in the West, specifically with Christmas, the earliest memories a lot of kids have are their Christmases. Good, bad, or indifferent. Some are horrific. And I think of the holidays as a very dark period of time. I call it surviving them every year.
Yeah.
Because of memories.
I'm sure my adoptive family won't appreciate this, but put it out there anyway. I did it in the first interview. I haven't yet. Just so everybody knows, Medicine Bear Wifebo is a name that I've adopted. I choose to go by Bear. The name I was given was John, and John Riddell. I don't use it. I don't address it. I don't acknowledge it. But that's the birth name on the fake birth certificate that I have.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's,
I just
wanted well, that's, to say that. No, that's actually great. Because it goes back into it again, of giving you a fake identity, of giving you an externalized consciousness that they then can use to jack into you. Because that's what the holidays basically are. That's what anything that's energetically harvesting operates on, the frequency of jacking into you and then using that to control you and move you as an emotional trigger.
Yeah, I don't, I mean.
Yeah, you're right. And just because my train of thought is going to that place at the moment for whatever reason you triggered it. But it's funny. I saw the excerpt for that goofy movie with George Clooney, Men Who Stare at Goats. Well, that's based on a real program.
Yeah.
The difference is that we didn't stare at goats. You could use it. And it's an extended version of astral projection where you can project into the enemy's mind and scramble their brains, for lack of a better way of putting it. So term soft kill comes to mind, where you do the damage and do the deed without actually physically taking a person out or putting a bullet down range and putting a bullet through their head or through their heart. It's psychological death. I mean, all these things are designed to open you up to the what they want and what they want to gear towards and what you're adaptable for. And whatever you're adaptable for, well, those are the programs. People tend to think they got a misunderstanding of MKUltra. Well, it's like, oh, if you got put into the program, you're automatically going to be put into this. No, they're going to try it first to see where you're adapted to.
There were hundreds of sub-programs.
And that's the whole reason why there was, because they had so many different areas of fringe science that they wanted to go into.
Yeah.
They're also, sometimes you're put into one program, and then, you know, you make some kind of change in your life or whatever, and then that changes your track, right? I mean, one of the things, like, for me, is that I, in my, like, early adulthood, and into, like, in my 20s, like late teens, 20s, 30s, I moved around a lot. I moved to different places. And I think that, like, they will find something for you wherever you're at, right? You know, and so it's what you're adaptable to in terms of, like, your own physical abilities, your own spiritual, psychic, all that kind of stuff, but also where you are in physical location and what they, like, what do they got for you? What can you, how can they use you here now with this and that? It isn't, but the triggers for all the different kinds of programs are all very similar. So when they know that somebody has been, you know, brought up in this situation or brought up in this program with this kind of training, okay, well, they have a similar set of triggers. They just do something else here. So that person already is able to be, as Randy put, jacked that way. It's now it's just what you're jacking them to do.
Yeah, one of the few handlers that I do recall was a gal that was 3 years older than I was. I was a freshman at that point in high school, and she took me under her wing, and she came over to the house. She spent time with my mom at the time, and my mom approved all of this. She's like, I'm going to take him, and I'll have him back tomorrow. And this, and she didn't care. I was 14 years old at the time. Didn't realize until years later what it was that I was being adapted for. Well, that was an aspect of Project Monarch, male prostitution. Take me in, send me to the to the rich, nasty old wrinkly old ladies that had the money. You know, go get the money, and if need be, take out a target. You know, it's just reality is, I mean, we've got all these things about fantasy and make believe, and reality is so much stranger and so much more awful than anything that any of these sickos in Hollywood could dream up. And most of it has been from things that they've pulled out of the programs anyway. Yep. That would make a great movie line. Let's make a movie out of that.
I think sometimes that's what they do for some of these things, is they get script writers together and they almost like have, you know, they have 10 different script writers write a script, and then they'll go with that one to run certain kinds of events and programs and whatever. And, you know, the others may get made into a movie or maybe not. And that's why we have so many movies where we're like, wait, didn't that just happen? Or the movie comes out first and then it happens. The plan all along was people who write the scripts for Hollywood are not that different than the people who write the scripts for, you know, all this other stuff. It's script writing. It's the same thing.
Well, and do you not think that maybe those places you traveled to in that time when you thought you were breaking up your life were perhaps part of a larger program as well?
Sure, yeah.
I've wondered about that. I've lived in different places. I've been places. I've been places that don't make sense.
Most of the time, in hindsight now, when I look at that, I was actually led by the nose to some of these places.
Yeah.
Very much so. And yeah, and some of it doesn't make any sense at all rationally. Like, you know, because it's your life, it makes sense to you on one level. But from the outside, and how that would ever be the logical next step from where you were before that, you're like, huh? You know what I mean? So, yeah.
So, Bear, moving out of your childhood years, at what point did you begin formally with the military?
18.
Okay.
18.
What branch were you in?
I was being geared and groomed for the Navy, but at the last minute, despite their disapproval, I chose to go to an Army recruiter and pissed off the adoptive family, something bad, but I went into the Army. At least that's where I started off at, technically. And then, of course, I was thinking I was going to be able to do my own thing and guide my own destiny. Little did I know that they were tracking everything I was doing. And okay, well, you're going to go that way. We'll steer you in the direction that we need you to go into and go into doing what we want. So I went in and went into one job career and got the training for it. And of course, doors opened up for that. And then I got pushed in, recommended. Here, look, why don't we go do this? And next thing you know, I'm going through Ranger School. I'm going through Sears training. I'm going through interrogation school, how to become an interrogator, how to extract information, and became very good at doing that job. The last place that I was at, I feel for the PFC. She always comes to mind. It's one of the more famous pictures out of 2003 when the scandal broke out of Al-Jarab. We went in and we helped set that up. I was running interrogations there, and we did whatever we had to do, and for our jollies and for our kicks, we would humiliate, for lack of a better way of putting it, humiliate the prisoners, and we did horrible things. And it's one of those cases where I was perpetrated against, and I think I was already starting to break down, and I started acting out. So for me, it was my way of lashing back, I guess. And unfortunately for them, the prisoners that were there, they got tortured and above and beyond. But that's just kind of the way the vicious cycle works. And it wasn't until mid-July of 2003 when the accident happened and our convoy got hit, and I got blown out of a vehicle and knocked unconscious 150 feet. And that's where things started really getting interesting for me. I started having the breakdown happen. I started having memories happen. I was no longer functional. I had a brain injury. I was brought back to Germany, then brought back to the States, held in isolation for 18 months, held in isolation in Germany for 6 months, and then went through extensive interrogation after interrogation after interrogation, trying to extract as much information out of me. And of course, at that point, I was already aware of, okay, well, I need to stay on track and stay on mission with this, because if I talk about this, I'm not going home. I'm not going anywhere. These people are going to do something worse to me or kill me or wipe me out. And luckily enough for me, it went the course that it did. And of course, I wound up having a lot of issues, and I turned to alcohol and went down that path, and it got really dark for a lot of years there for me for a while. And at the rear end of that is when I happened to manage to find myself in Pahrump, Nevada, coming across Dave Corso. And like I said, Dave was there. I told Randy the story. When I walked into his computer shop to get my computer fixed, it was instantaneous. And it was a little wild down the road when Dave actually said, you know, when I first met you, the minute you walked into my store, my shop, the first thought that came to mind was kill this son of a bitch. And that's how he and I met. And
that would be the first part of the program that's going to come up, because that's the compartmentalization layer. That's White Wolf von Atzikin that described that years ago. It's basically, if I ever see you again, I'll have to kill you, which was the code to keep everybody compartmentalized, separated, and not being able to reattach to any human level with any of the programs or participants in the programs.
Just because I feel like a little humor. How astute of you.
I'm just nutshelling things as we go along.
Yeah, I think we've got a little bit of a hodgepodge and bouncing a little bit over all over the place, but I think your listeners are all pretty adapted to following that kind of bouncing ball, so I'm not too worried.
Yeah, and I kind of tossed one in there myself because I was trying to vocalize something. I don't think I completely got this out of my head yet.
I think, let me pick up, with, you're still on the holiday thing a little bit? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
So
go ahead.
Okay, so with the holidays, I never liked them as well. Lots of people, there's lots of people in general that don't, but I do find that all of us, many, many people in our kind of community definitely don't. I think there's, that was a time when I would always feel extremely separate from everybody else, extremely isolated. And in fact, like, I only have solo memories of holidays. Like, I don't remember sitting around the tree with my family. I remember walking downstairs in the middle of the night to look at the Christmas tree by myself. I remember, you know, I also, like, had memories where it was like, you know, a lot of the memories were about Christmas lights, about the Christmas lights, which I think really plays to something else because, you know, they use a lot of the red, green, and different kinds of triggering with red, green, and other colors as well, but largely with red and green for triggering stuff. But the other thing, and this is probably my strongest memory of Christmas from childhood, is being sang to in German. And that's the only, my mother would always sing O Christmas Tree in German, always. And I didn't know any other German at all. Even I had a gymnastics coach that at a certain point later that spoke that also prompted. He was Austrian. He prompted in German. Certain commands and certain scolding in German, but then otherwise spoke to us in English. So to me, there was like this weird stuff with the lights and with the German song. And at the time, I didn't have any idea what it meant. But in hindsight, like, you know, what was going on when I was going downstairs in the middle of the night to look at the Christmas tree by myself, right? So these are some of the kinds of bizarre memories that also contain hooks or they contain threads that now that we know sort of what's going on.
Well, it is a form of programming. It's cultural programming.
It's
broad scale cultural programming. Then on the personal level, yeah, it comes down into what your individual proclivity is in terms of they make you want something. They make you externalize your emotional, psychic energy into something that's an invention, a creation, and a hypnosis.
It's
a state of hypnosis.
That also, during that period of time where you're wanting that thing can be used as a programming tool.
That's exactly what it is being used for.
I remember the year I wanted the Rubik's Cube. Like, literally, like, that consumed my thoughts. And was it really consuming my thoughts because I wanted it so badly? Or do they realize this child wants this for this period of time? This could be used to manipulate the child to do what we want the child to do. You know, you get to play with this for, you know, we have one over here. You can play with that. Oh, I want my own. You can play with this one for a half an hour. You know, that kind of crap. And then, you know, when you finally get, you know how when you finally get your toy you want on Christmas? Like, you play with it for like a few weeks and then you're over it. But that period of time, when you start wanting it and when you actually get it, it is controlling your life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's controlling your long-term behavior, which is exactly how programming works.
Yeah,
it's funny. Emma was talking about the Christmas lights. I still get a sick feeling when she was talking about it. Red, green, green, blue, green, green, red, green, green, blue.
Yep,
I remember it, and
it also correlates to. So you remember, you know, the Simon Says, and there was the electronic version of Simon Says that had the red, God, light, yellow, green, blue. Like, I have memories of having to remember the patterns on that, not just to play the game, because the game was, like, simple and easy to do, but, like, much longer, red, red, green, just like you were saying. Like,
remember, now let's take the conversation back a step to what you and I have talked about in terms of those, what came up with Andy Bishago, the Quizinator, or the machines that are throwing all the imagery that was both used as a test and also as a programming routine in running these lights, running these images, into your brain and then calibrating the rapidity with which you're able to process that data, or on the cellular level, how you're processing and internalizing those messages, and even the sequences themselves, being able to remember the type of sequence that John just, I'm sorry, that Bear just enumerated there.
I used to also have, tell me if this rings any bell for either of you, but I would learn songs, but I wouldn't, like, I didn't play the piano, but someone would play songs on the piano, and I wouldn't learn the words to the song, I would do numbers with them. So there was one piano song that was like about someone used to play, but when they would play it, I would go 1-3-5-5-5-6-6-5. Mm. I wouldn't sing the words, I wouldn't ever learn to play the piano, but I had to know that I had a number routine that I did to 1-3-5-5-5-6. I still remember 6-6-5-1-3-5-5-5-4-3-2. Why? I would not sing the words, I would not play the song, I would sing numbers while they played the song. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
I'm going to have to look it up. You're saying that, and it recurred to me. Stuck in my head, it was a cadence and a very famous piece of music, and I've come to find out, I wish I could remember the name. It's Something Blue, and I forgot the name of it, and I forgot the composer, but the gist of it was, it was very hypnotic. It would take you to that place, yep. And they would use it when we were doing the calisthenics, or what we thought were calisthenics, yep. When in fact it was forms of martial arts, and we were learning how to move and flow and then direct the energy so that we could make our blows and our attacks fatal.
I think some of these musics, like I would do like a little, not like a regular dance routine, but like a pattern on the floor with my feet. Like,
yeah.
Five, 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 like not something you would do for normal dancing, but like almost like when you see people doing those like dance revolution kind of things where it's not really dancing, but they're like stepping in like funny patterns. Yeah, like I do think that there's something to that kind of, you think you're doing one thing, but you're really doing something else. Yeah, I don't, yeah. Sorry, I'm not there.
So I guess the question becomes, is that a screen memory? Is it... those patterns are hidden in the programming in a clever, novel kind of way so that they're recalled on demand?
In my earliest recollection of things that were for recall and memory type things like you're talking about were the flashcards. Mm-hmm. Red dot, blue dot, yellow dot, green dot, and you'd have to remember them and then be behind a partition. Where's the red card? Where's the blue card?
That's yeah.
And then the 3D puzzles. I used to get 3D puzzles. Going back into it, these were all things that were used as instruction, again, to see where your aptitude and abilities were and where you're more geared toward and more suited towards, so they could figure out, okay, well, we're finished with him in the initial phase. Let's get this one into this program first and start with and see how far we can take him with this. And if he doesn't break, we'll see if we can push him into this, push him into that. And everything's up to the point. You're an expendable item all the way through it with the programs. People thinking, I've been told, Bear, once you're into that, you're going to be successful, and you know, their goal is to, you know, they're going to spend millions and thousands of dollars on each one of your children they put through these programs. You don't seem to understand. That's the reason why there's such a large group of us, because so many would die of attrition. I mean, the first couple of weeks, you'd lose half your class. The next couple of weeks, and it drops off and drops off. And it's just like going through Ranger school or any of the other elite special forces schools. You may start off with a class of 300. Your graduating class may only be 12 members. I mean, the attrition rate and the cutoff. And unfortunately, when you drop out as a child through the MK Ultra, you don't normally get to go home and play recess. You're normally never heard of again. You don't get to grow up. You're not growing old. You're certainly not going to see your early 20s. You're not going to have your first girlfriend. You're not going to get your first kiss. you cease to exist. So I hate the notion that for so many years, so many things have been projected and people have got such wide variety of fantasy built around
it. Yeah.
And they build it up to be, you know, it's really not that bad. Oh, the programs and all the torture and all that, that was bad. No, you don't understand the end result of what happened to a large percent of these kids. They're dead. They don't exist anymore. Why do people like me want to come forward and speak up? For those that are coming forward now that have the possibility of going through the horrific stuff that I went through, and say they do survive, that's bad enough. What's worse, you put one of these small children through this, and they're never heard of again. They don't go on to be an ultra. They don't go on to be a monarch. They don't go on to be a Corey Feldman. They don't become successful. They're not a tool to be used for
anything. Or they don't get to be a Corey Good either.
Exactly.
Well, and then, you know, you just touched on something. I just recently had an email exchange with Jay Widener, who's an executive producer at Gaia TV, which puts out Cosmic Disclosure. With Corey Good and David Wilcock.
Yes,
one of the things that I told Jay Widener in the course of the interviews is I have a problem with Corey Good just on the basis that, quite frankly, I haven't seen Corey exhibit the trauma of an actual survivor. What I've seen is a braggadocious asshole who invented a bunch of stories. But in the context of this communication, what I said to Jay is, the one thing Corey doesn't talk about is how many people died in those programs that he allegedly says he came out of. And this is where I know the ring of truth when I talk to survivors versus people who are posers or people who have been put out there into the media, whether it's the alternative media or the mainstream media, who are actors. Is that you know when you're talking to somebody who's a legitimate survivor because they carry the wounds in their psyche and they come up real easily, just quite frankly, as we've seen with you even over the course of this interview so far, Bear. I mean, this is difficult and, you know, it's kind of a naked process because I'm watching your facial expressions and I'm watching how you move and I'm hearing your voice. And I know a lot of this is painful. And that is the ring of truth. There isn't any glory in this. They're not going to give Medicine Bear a lot of money to do a TV series extolling the virtues of MK Delta or any other program because those programs aren't glorious. Those programs were brutal.
That they were. Yeah. Yeah, you summed it up pretty well there, Randy.
Well, and I need to, you know, I need to say that because people like you do this just to honor the memory of the ones that were lost in these programs and also to keep alive the hope that we can end this and end these programs, which I know is something that Duncan's talked about as well. This is just the difficulty of getting this message across in a way that I don't think people understand, but we have it here.
Apologize.
No, don't apologize.
I don't apologize at all. I mean, this is the reality of this. You know what I mean? And, you know, I think that
this is why we do what we're doing.
Why we do it? And I don't. Yeah. You know, I don't know how old you are, Bear.
I'm 50.
You're 50. You know, I think at some point in the programs there have been some changes and it isn't quite that way anymore because there's been the increasing use of technology and artificial intelligence and different kinds of targeting and harassment and things like that. But that doesn't mean that there's any less of a travesty going on because there's a bunch of people wandering around with thoughts that aren't their own, lives that aren't their own, not in control of their own destiny and things like that, which is, you know, the modern day version of the kind of die-off that was in your generation. You know what I mean? Like you have people out here who like, you know, don't even understand what is driving them, what is causing them to do the things that they're doing. And so it's like a completely different kind of thing than what you were talking about. Like, I think that that was, you know, I think the way the programs work now are a little bit different than that. You know what I mean? And I think sort of what we do on this show here, like we talk about all different possibilities of these things going on. But the one thing that I know is that, you know, to people who, there's so much trauma involved with any of this, whether it's been through electronic harassment, whether it's been through the kind of physical training you're talking about, whether it's been through sexual abuse or, you know, that kind of thing, that you know you're talking to somebody who's been through something when they have the visceral, the physical reaction, the emotional yeah. reaction that you're having. You know, like sometimes even when Randy and I are having private conversations, like, you know,
we literally make each other sick.
Randy, like, you know, when you, yeah. I don't know if you've ever read Elisa Yee's book, but quite literally when I was reading her book, I was vomiting. I was, you know, I had to keep a bag next to my bed. You know what I mean? And, yeah. you know, maybe for most people that wouldn't happen, but when you know from one person who's been through something, and I don't think I've been through anything anywhere near as horrific as what she had been through, but the kind of reaction that I was having to it told me that there's something here I really needed to look at. You know what I mean? And that's the same kind of raw, this raw thing that happens when you're sitting here talking and you know, like there is lots of bodies in this trail. There's lots, and for the people who are alive, some of the, you know, like maybe we're some of the lucky ones, you know what I mean? Like we're able to sit here and talk about it. And, you know, I think there's, you know, for myself, I'm still trying to sort out what went on for myself. And I'm in the space where a lot of times I hear stories and I'm like, well, gee, kind of what I've been through is nothing, nowhere near as bad as that. But then other times I'm like, well, I'm still a 42-year-old person who's not really ever been able to have an appropriate, you know, kind of relationship with another adult. You know what I mean? So these are the kinds of things. These are you know, the kinds of that's damaging to a person. You know what I mean? That like the kind of damage that happens. It isn't just like any of us are here skipping along, having the typical, you know, normal, happy day-to-day, regular life. Like everything when I look at survivor people like you, people like Duncan, people like Elisa, like every facet of their life, this has intruded on. You know what I mean? But we're lucky because, or you guys are lucky, or however we want to put this, because we're here. We don't know about these other people who aren't here, or who are here but don't even know what happened to them because they're so fucked up. You know what I mean? It's scary. It's scary and it's upsetting. And that's one of the things that I find the most disturbing is I'm coming to the point where I think that there's a lot more of us than what people realize. And they just haven't realized it yet. And to me, that's almost even scarier to like not know what has gone on in your own life, in your own head, in your own, you know what I mean? That's terrifying to me.
You wind up growing up. I mean, when the barriers start breaking down, there's so many false memories. And yeah. Wait a minute, that didn't, like I was describing, that place never existed. So what the hell really happened? Where the hell was I really? Oh, well, here you were. There's a photograph. One photograph that I saw, and unfortunately, he cut me off before I could download it and save it. Otherwise, I would have presented it. But here I am in a special little uniform right next to him in front of the Presidio. Well, what the hell went on in the Presidio? When I started diving into it, it made me sick. And then Aquino, turns out Aquino was a friend of that family. I'm like, are you kidding me? How could I not be connected to all this garbage?
Isn't it?
I was geared for it.
It is so weird when you're like, especially when you start to have suspicions about this kind of stuff and you look into a little bit and there's a part of your mind that's like, nah, that couldn't be me. But then stuff like that happens and you're like, how does that make any sense? Like, how did I end up right in the middle of that pile of, you know, whatever? It's weird, man. And yeah. It's weird.
Okay, man. Which rabbit hole do we want to jump down next? Now it's going from the upset to the anger.
Maybe it's the pressure that's off in terms of this is being a patron segment. I've sort of left this go wide and far and deep at the same time. And I'm trying to give it some space to air so that as we back out of this tonight, we're not leaving it on a downer.
Yeah. overall, you know, my hope, like I shared with Storm, I shared with Duncan, I've shared with you, I've shared with Emily. When Duncan reached out and he told me after Houston, when he publicly came out, he said, this is the last time I'm going to be talking about this publicly or privately, and I'm passing on a torch. Well, I'm not here to let you know the torch that he passed this aspect of this. And what I'm referring to here, folks, is nothing more than and nothing but MKUltra. He passed that torch on to me. And I accepted it with some stipulations, of course. And those stipulations being that I have no desire, no want, no need, nor am I willing to go down the same path that has already been beaten for 20 some odd years. I want to bring something new and refreshing. And okay, yeah, this has happened. The programs are horrible. What do we do now? How do we take all that horrible garbage, that vile muck and nasty shit, and turn it into something that could be a useful tool to heal from? That's what I had the lodge for.
We
which points us, that actually was a really nice turnaround there, brother. I like that.
We reclaim the powers that they knew we had and tried to steal from us.
It still blows me away. I know Storm and I talk about this all the time. The last thing that any of these sons of bitches ever wanted, and they couldn't have, this has got to be their worst nightmare. You got four of us that wound up finding each other, four of us that wound up getting connected to each other, four of us that wound up considering each other brothers and communicating and getting to know each other and helping each other and being there for one another and surviving this stuff and the worst aspects of the worst programs that they had to offer. Four of us, and I still hate the term, bona fide, true to form, killing machine, super soldier, you name it, were their worst nightmare come true. Not only are we aware of what's happened to us, we're also healing from it, we're helping each other heal from it, and we're putting the truth out there to the best that we know how to do. And when we screw up and say something false, I will gladly go back on in a heartbeat, and I'll reach out to Randy or you, and I'm like, you know what, that wasn't true. I reached out to Randy a couple weeks. You know, dude, I went on the first interview. What I said about this wasn't the truth. Here's what the truth is. He's like, don't worry about it. It happens. But that's what's important to me.
Duncan, interestingly enough, in Houston, corrected the record on a number of things that over the years, his narrative, his understanding of the narrative was changed, refined, updated. This is all part of a process. It's actually very normal. And I'll draw this back again. You don't regain your memories overnight. You may have a traumatic event that peels back the veil, but this is a very long process of opening up, as it needs to be, obviously, because you can't deal with it all at one time. But the fact that certain memories are going to come through with screens, some are going to be false, some are going to be colored, twisted, tinted, whatever, is simply part of what they did in the cracked funhouse mirror that they implanted into people.
Yeah.
And so we always leave that narrative open. Hopefully what I'm going to be able to do is, what happened in Houston was, and this is the typical, just like we lost you for 5 minutes early in this interview. One person with a professional grade camera, plus me with my phone, videoing and recording Duncan and Susan's speech in Houston. And what happened? Three memory cards failed on the camera. I ran out of memory on my phone. I used my wife's phone to film one segment of it. And then my phone disappeared in Houston. With the footage. Now we have an audio recording, and the audio recording when I got back from Houston was on an SD card. It was done with a Zoom H2 recorder. Has these sudden white noise glitches coming in over the audio. Oh, gee. You think? No, what are the chances of that? So we battle the forces of technology. We battle the forces that want to just, if they can't stop you, they're going to make your life goddamn miserable doing this.
Yeah, and like I told you, when I brought it up to Duncan originally, and he said, you know, if you want to go forward, I'll be there to support you. And I think it would be time. I think it's time. I've been holding the torch more or less by myself for a long time. There's a ton of people out there that are talking about this, but there's a ton of them that are just full of shit.
There are. And, yeah. Yeah, there are.
The beauty of, I think, what I'm able to bring, that not only for a survivor of this, a survivor of the sexual abuse aspect of it and that monarch aspect of it, like, you know, I've been formally trained in the satanic arts. I've been through the Black Church. I've been through the Native American. I'm going through the Celtic. I've been through the Druidic. I've been through the Viking stuff. All of that stuff originally was brought in as tools to use for the cabal, for the programs, to serve a purpose, to serve their needs. What I'm doing now is taking all that knowledge and taking all those teachings, and I'm turning the tables with it, and I'm able to use that information. So yeah, like I just dealt with the gal in Louisiana, you may know her, Stacy. She was dealing with the vampire cult down there.
Mm-hmm.
Because of my background, what I've been through and my knowledge, I was able to step in from here in Nevada to help her and take aid to her astrally and take care of the problem for her. I wouldn't have been able to do that had I not been exposed to those teachings and those tools early on. So that's how we can take this thing to a whole different level and turn the tables on these guys. And I know they're running for the hills. They're scared. We're watching it all start to crumble, and I'm grateful for it. It's about damn time. They're being exposed. And I'm here to tell you, every one of you sons of bitches, yep, I'm coming. I'm coming for you. Understand that. I'm not backing down. I will not run. I'm here. I am. You want some? Come get some.
And I know that comes from a place inside of you that's very well vowed to doing exactly that. We've had many conversations about that there. The denouement is really when you turn the weapon against the sword craftsman.
And that's the aspect that enables me to get through interviews and things like this, because I've got something to hold on to. You know, I've got a great support system. I've got great brothers. I got a great sister I'm getting to know. And as we all pull together, this community is going to get stronger, more unified, and we're going to become a force to be reckoned with. And it's about time.
And your words are going out to a community of people who are aligned with this purpose as well. We know a lot of our listeners because we talk to them. We know who they are. We know their backgrounds. And we know that they're also people that have basically vowed they're going to turn this system around. And the system is actually, it's interesting how badly now it's dissembling itself. You just look at Las Vegas shooting.
I mean, is this the biggest shit show you've ever seen in your entire life?
Well, here we are. We're talking about it 2 weeks later. The narrative's now changed a half dozen times. The timeline doesn't work anymore. Witnesses are disappearing. I mean, the security guards disappeared, for God's sake.
But the best part, and this is the part that this is what everybody needs to just understand this part. The sheriff was at the press conference the other day and said, in this press conference, I will not be taking questions. I'll only be reading from my narrative. That's what he's, that was, that I will only be reading from my from the narrative that I've been provided. And the day before, they specifically told a reporter to stop asking a particular question. So I don't really know what more, like, we need to, I don't, the whole thing.
Yeah, don't ask questions. You're screwing up my script here.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Screenwriters Guild stepping in to write the event after it already occurred. Reverse engineer it, basically.
Back to the script writing.
Like, yeah, so, we're back to that.
Apparently they forgot to script the entire press conference. They let one reporter in who was going to ask an inconvenient question.
What was the name of that movie that came out a few years ago with all the marionettes? Oh, God dang it. It was really bad.
Marionettes are really bad. Let's not talk about marionettes right now.
Oh, that goes back into another old memory.
Right. Yeah, I have a set of marionette memories. Yeah. Interesting
one. And I apologize to the listeners, but the only way I can remember it is...
I know what movie...
America, fuck yeah. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know the one you're talking about, and it's escaping my top of my brain.
You take that movie, and you take the Super Troopers, and you combine it together, and that pretty much sums up the narrative of the garbage jackasses are putting out there now. They don't know their ass anymore.
Well, the only way you displace bad information is with good information. The genuine destroys the counterfeit. That's what we're here for. Bear, before we back out of here, because we're plumb out of time, tell people where they can find information on Rainbow People's Lodge.
Well, we're on the internet. We've got our website. It's www.rpmlmedicinelodge.org. Simple enough.
Okay, Emily, anything else?
Right. No, I think that's this has kind of been a windabout all over the place, but this is sort of what happens. I mean, Randy and I have a lot of private conversations, and they're definitely not linear, and I think that's the way these...
We can't script this. This is...
The way these memories work and come back and present themselves and pop up here and there is not linear, and it's not always completely logical, and but this is what happens, and I know, because I hear from a lot of you out there that a lot of you are going through some of these things, and so these are the kind of conversations we have and that need to be had, and sometimes things that one says brings up a memory for the other. Like, I don't know what the heck just happened when you were talking about the working with somebody with the vampire cult. Like, I just had the most intense, like, feel like something poking into my brain there and some strange pressure. I have no idea why that would be or what that means, but I've learned to pay very, very close attention to the physical sensations in the body when we talk about these things. And I advise the listeners to as well. And we will have these conversations and as long as we need to until we put an end to this kind of stuff, until we have reclaimed our bodies, our lives and our world, because it belongs to us. It does not belong to them. They have not been any kind of stewards of anything, and they're not the boss of us anyway. So,
I think that's a good place to leave it. Bear, thanks for coming on with us, brother.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate that level of transparency that you allowed us to share with you tonight. And for being able to kind of walk about some pretty rugged terrain. We wish you the best out there with the Rainbow People's Lodge and the work that you're doing. We'll be in touch. You be in touch. Future interviewers, thanks for supporting us and making our initial campaign a success. It's Off Planet Radio, Off Planet TV. The truth is out there. It's inside you. Now go and find it. Good night. Don't know.
You are listening to Off Planet Radio at offplanetradio.com. I don't know.